Elchim Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Welcome back to Elchim Talks, our investment commentary podcast. I'm Mark Chappell, investment writer. Joining me in the studio today is the head of our politics and policy research group, asset allocation strategist Chris Jeffrey, and fixed income portfolio manager Alex Mack. Chris, Alex, thanks very much for being here.
Absolute pleasure.
Cheers.
Global economies are increasingly moving to a late cycle dynamic that is closer to the next economic downturn. Chris, are the old ways for policymakers to deal with a recession broken?
Let's start with the issue of are we approaching late cycle? So the US expansion has been running for about the last 9 years. Mm-hmm. That's getting pretty long in the tooth. And there's nothing definitive that means, you know, 10 years is possible, 12 years is possible. Australia has been going through a nearly quarter century of economic expansion. Yeah. But the odds are just getting worse from as we go year to year. So then kind of what is the policy response we've seen in every previous downturn? Alex and Ian Hutchinson, another portfolio management fixed income team, have been looking at the size of the policy response from monetary authorities. Mm-hmm. It's of the order of magnitude of 300 to 400 basis points of short-term rates, 200 to 300 basis points off long-term rates.
That's quite big interest rate cuts that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. If central bankers were old Mother Hubbard, they're going to go to the cupboard and they're going to find that cupboard is bare if we are faced with a recession over the course of the next couple of years. The Fed, plausibly, got room to cut of an order of magnitude that's similar to what we've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. In the UK, in the Eurozone, in Japan, we're still at or very close to rock bottom.
Yeah, and so what we've tried to do in these in the pieces that we've released, we've looked at where they might turn next. And so we started by looking at what are the next logical steps, or what we think they will think are the next logical steps, which is more important than what we would do.
So by they, you mean monetary policymakers?
Yes, we do, yeah. And then look at the framework within which monetary policy operates. So we looked at the institutional framework, mm-hmm. within which monetary policy operates. So what are the laws that govern what they can currently do, and how do you change those laws within different jurisdictions? And then one of where we want to take this in the future is to look at the politics of this, the politics of monetary policy and the politics of changing monetary policy.
You mentioned the cupboard was looking rather bare there, Chris. And so if policymakers needed to reflate the global economy in 2019, 2020, say, in the next few years, what tools could they use as they stand?
So I think the first thing we just need to recognize is that there is a huge amount of flexibility inherent in the system here. Mm-hmm. So Ben Bernanke, former chair of the Federal Reserve System, said in the last financial crisis, there are no atheists in a foxhole and no ideologues in a financial crisis, by which he meant that when the system comes under stress, policymakers innovate. Mm-hmm. So we saw that in Europe. You know, there was a no bailout clause in the EU treaty. Countries got bailed out. We saw that in the US, where the Fed is prohibited from buying corporate securities or equity securities. We saw special purpose vehicles set up to achieve that effect. So that means that we kind of just need to be open-minded about what could they do. So then what could they do? The list of kind of things that we know they could do, most obviously, is the stuff they've done before. So we could have large-scale asset purchases. Mm-hmm. It's the phrase that the Federal Reserve likes to use. QE, quantitative easing, is the one that most of the rest of us use. So we could see QE again on a scale of several trillion dollars. So the Fed's balance sheet as a share of US GDP has already shrunk by something from around 25% to close to 20%. There's no reason why we couldn't see that ramped back up again. You enter into a much more knotty problem in the Eurozone, given that they have boxed themselves in with constraints on how much they can buy, what share of debt they can buy, what share of individual securities they can buy.
They've been quite more prescriptive within their rules around their QE programs, you mean?
They've chosen to define it in very legal terms, that they see it as a violation of their legal responsibilities and obligations if they were to own blocking minorities in certain debt securities. And that's a big problem. Sorry, Alex.
No, it's fine. But it's also worth noting what they're trying to do here by expanding their assets, their balance sheets, and by buying government bonds. So if traditionally they've if we went back pre the financial crisis, we would have talked about monetary policy makers controlling interest rates by moving short-dated interest rates. Mm-hmm. And longer-term purchases of longer-term government debt effectively allowed them to pull interest rates down along the curve,
as it were. Over a longer time horizon.
For interest rates of different maturities.
Okay.
Yeah. And we can talk about the ways that they did that, so that whether it was through the actual purchase or whether it was through the signal mm-hmm. that purchases sent that rates weren't going up for a long period of time, so called forward guidance. But now I think we're in a situation where not only within the Eurozone are they running out of bonds they can buy legally because of the things that Chris was talking about, but also even if they wanted to, they can't move interest rates down very far, certainly not far enough that you would enough to counter what we've typically seen in a recession.
Mm-hmm. So I think the easy things they can do, it talks about extending QE. Japan has now kind of shown us the way in terms of an explicit peg on a long-term interest rate. And then it becomes a question of, okay, well, what's in scope if they need to move beyond controlling long-dated interest rates? In previous crises, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, the Bank of Japan have actively bought equities. Now, we've never got there in Europe. We would need to invent some kind of legal structure that allowed the US to get there. But that's a kind of obvious next step if it's needed. Directly buying equities has a impact on the households and corporate sector through a traditional wealth channel. And then you get into the really funky stuff where we're talking about helicopter money as a potential option, which is... I guess we could have a separate podcast all about this topic. But I think by helicopter money, what we mean is a permanent monetary financing of a temporary fiscal expansion. And we haven't quite crossed that Rubicon in the interventions that we've seen in the aftermath of the last crisis.
So I'm so glad you brought up helicopter money, because this was pretty much everywhere where you looked in the financial press around 2016, just a couple of years ago. And people... often through the epithet that Japan and the actions of the Bank of Japan post-financial crisis was helicopter money by default. Would you kind of agree with that characterization?
Yeah, so I think you could look at QE everywhere that central banks have been buying government bonds. And if you're willing to say that that's lowered the financing cost of those governments, then you can say that it's allowed them to spend more than they otherwise would have done. It's allowed them to cut less, it's still spending more than they otherwise would have done. So you could say that in most places where you've seen QE, you've seen a fiscal impact and a monetary policy impact going hand in hand. But one thing that the Bank of Japan has been very clear, because it's illegal, it's illegal within the Constitution, they've been very clear to try and de-emphasise the monetary financing that's going on. Mm-hmm. I think one of the key things for us with helicopter money is the explicit link you create between one and the other. And that has real psychological impacts.
Right, the link between which elements here?
Oh, sorry, yeah. The link between the bond buying and extra spending. I am financing this by printing money. I'm creating a permanent hole in the central bank's balance sheet that I'm promising not to fill.
So, yeah, I mean, I think another way of kind of thinking about the kind of post-crisis environment is there's been this mantra everywhere, but especially true, I suppose, in the UK, that you run simultaneously loose monetary policy and tight fiscal policy. And that mix is deemed to be constructive in the medium term because you reduce interest rate costs for everybody in the private sector and you kind of right fiscal balances for the public sector. Helicopter money is quite different. It's loose monetary and loose fiscal. And in Japan, we haven't quite got there. We still have a debate every year about shall we raise the consumption tax to try and rein in fiscal spending. But it's clearly there in principle as the option in the next downturn. If central banks, policymakers generally are looking around for where's my bazooka in the next crisis, that's where it is.
I mean, and that leads us on more to the UK discussion where, I mean, we're recording this just after the Labour conference has wrapped up, but there is this kind of element of bazooka policymaking of... people's QE, to take that phrase. Could you explain a little bit more about how that might be implemented and what kind of effect would that have for the UK economy?
I think maybe take a step back and ask how we ended up here. I think that the People's QE and the Labour Party's proposal here speaks a lot to the way that QE is generally thought about and generally portrayed in the media. Mm-hmm. So central banks recently have gone out of their way, particularly the ECB and the Bank of England, has gone out of their way to try and say that QE isn't or hasn't increased inequality within the various jurisdictions.
Which I guess is quite often the media narrative around QE, is that QE has really kind of been great for asset owners, household owners, etc. But as a side effect, post the financial crisis, it's an easy element in modern policymaking to pin the blame on.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the truth in that underlying claim that QE has led to higher inequality, and I would tend to say that it has.
Okay.
But whatever the truth, I think what's really important is that it is out there as a narrative in the media, and it's a narrative that's very difficult to break. Mm. It's a narrative that's very difficult to explain to people. Because the value of your pension has gone up, and the value of future government liabilities.
It's a very technical conversation to be having with
absolutely.
With
people. I think it'd be something that's very difficult to break. So I think we're likely to go into the next crisis with that as a prevailing undercurrent, if you will, within the media, and particularly here within the UK, within the opposition party.
Yeah. So kind of what really is People's QE as a proposal? It's the government builds bridges and roads and other infrastructure projects, and the Bank of England pays for it. And you can have a long debate about exactly how that is structured. So is it they're buying ordinary government bonds to implicitly pay for it? Are they buying so-called infrastructure bonds to more explicitly pay for it? I mean, you know, we're not talking about somebody reversing a truck to the back of the Bank of England and filling it up with £50 notes, which are then going to get distributed willy-nilly. But in principle, the action is quite similar, that you've got monetary financing of fiscal policy. So then how will we expect the market to react to that? Well, you've got bigger deficits. Most people would normally say bigger deficits means higher yields through some kind of crowding out effect, but which mean there's only so much savings to go around, and if the government wants more of that savings, there needs to be higher interest rates to make people channel it towards the government. Mm-hmm. But if you then have a central bank paying for it, then you don't necessarily get the interest rate channel, but you immediately start to worry about what the currency effect might be. So, you know, the only places where we have seen genuine helicopter money or people's QE type mechanisms in place, mm-hmm. certainly in the second half of the 20th century and the first half of the 21st century, have been in emerging markets. And they've typically been associated with bouts of currency volatility and currency weakness.
Which countries are we talking about here?
Yeah. Well, you don't get into a very distinguished list of of countries when you're talking about direct financing of deficits. Mm. But then that kind of risks us thinking that this is kind of crazy banana republic type economics. But then the hall of mirrors you can end up in here is it actually can be a very sensible solution to a problem of a chronic demand shortfall and very low inflation expectations.
For long-term public service kind of projects, such as the infrastructure building that we're talking about.
It's not obviously a crazy policy. The thing that I guess makes it very difficult right now is that it's explicitly illegal in the EU treaty. So the EU treaty could not be more clear about the prohibition of monetary financing by European central banks, and the S on the end of that is really important here. The Bank of England is currently one of the European central banks, as defined by that treaty. Come March, April next year, it won't be anymore. So the gloves are off to a certain extent once we leave the EU. And that is one of the reasons why the more we kind of look at this issue, the country which has the most ability, we think, both because of the legal framework, the institutional framework, and the political framework to push through these kind of policies is the UK.
So why is that? What makes the Bank of England so special, Alex?
Well, so Chris has alluded to as leaving the European Union, which obviously makes things a lot easier. But then there's also an interesting part within the Bank of England Act, where the Chancellor can tell the Governor of the Bank of England what to do, and only then has to bring it back to Parliament 30 days later.
So the independence that Gordon Brown enshrined not that long ago can actually be
more malleable than perhaps people understand the central banks as they currently are.
Yes, yeah, so I'm going to read out. I've got it in front of me. So this is from the Bank of England Act 1998. The Treasury, after consultation with the Governor of the Bank, may by order give the Bank directions with respect to monetary policy if they are satisfied that the directions are required in the public interest and by extreme economic circumstances. Now, those last two clauses are pretty vague. I mean, what is the public interest and what are extreme economic circumstances? People can choose to define those in the way that they see fit.
And then if we look at we talk about the legal framework here, but we can compare that to the European European treaties that Chris was talking about earlier. But then think about the political framework as well. How have we set up government to enable us to make laws? And within Britain, if John McDonnell there is a Labour Party Chancellor, it is likely that Labour Party Chancellor has a majority in Parliament. It's probably not the case. Legislating in Europe is a much, much more difficult proposition where you have to get agreement amongst all of the member states. And similarly, in the US, in the US you see policy tends to come through committees rather than coming through an individual here, the Treasury, but the Chancellor, proposing this is what I'm going to do and I've done it and now we can vote on it.
There's a very decisive element to British politics that I think people kind of forget about when taking Britain as a polity within the world political system.
Yeah, I mean, let's just think back to the US tax cuts that happened at the back end of last year. Mm. I mean, that was an extraordinarily drawn-out process of horse trading within primarily the Senate to get the number of senators over the line that was necessary.
And that's despite a full majority of congressional House of Representatives, Senate, and the White House all being in the hands of the same party.
Yep. Or we think about the attempts at unwinding Obamacare, so sort of undoing healthcare reform, ultimately collapsed because of an inability to get their ducks in a row amongst the US senators. The UK system is just very different. You have kind of very centralized party power. It's been referred to as an elected dictatorship. the person who commands a majority of the House of Commons doesn't have a written constitution that constrains them. They don't have a separation of powers between the executive and the legislature that constrains them. They don't have, ultimately, the House of Lords doesn't really constrain them because they can be overruled. So, the Prime Minister, the government of the day, is in a very powerful position in the UK to enact these kind of changes. So it just means that when we're thinking about, market conditions today and the balance of risks around particular prices, there is a higher probability, and we're not saying it's our central case, we're just saying there's a higher probability of these kind of policies being introduced in the UK than elsewhere. And you've got to be aware of that and think about that when considering sterling exposure, when considering gilts exposure, when considering UK equity exposure.
I'm really glad you brought in the investment, certainly long-term investors like ourselves and our clients, because there is this element of once you've done something once, it is very easy to do it again. And once a government has tapped that money tree, for example, it's very likely that investors would jump to envisaging the future government when it swings from party to party, employing the same methodology. Could you talk to us a little bit more about the kind of precedent that helicopter money sets?
I think you can pick your metaphor. It's opening Pandora's box. It's crossing the Rubicon. I think the stylized fact is that income tax was introduced in the United Kingdom to fight the Napoleonic War. Last time I checked, we were no longer fighting Napoleon and we still had income tax. Yes, it's exactly these kind of temptations is the reason why we have independent central banks. I mean, independent central banks are, in the grand scheme of things, a reasonably recent phenomenon. We're talking about something in the UK. It's a, as you said earlier, a Gordon Brown invention from the late 1990s. In other parts of the world, similarly, the kind of big push to have independent central banks targeting inflation is a story of the last 20 or 30 years. Now, the irony, I guess, of the situation we're in is that perhaps they've just been a bit too successful in keeping inflation low and stable. Mm. And the only experience we have historically of a country which becomes ultimately successful in nailing down the price level and therefore has zero inflation or deflation at times is Japan. And they're still struggling to come out the other side of it. So, yes, it absolutely is a temptation that governments will kind of reach into this toolbox again and again. And it's just like the way we talk about QE now. Nobody really thinks about QE as being particularly unconventional. Think back to 2008, QE was a massively unconventional policy. And when the Fed introduced it, there was a huge furore about, well, how could they be buying U.S. government bonds? And wasn't this financing the deficit? And wasn't it going to lead to hyperinflation?
Exactly.
This is Zimbabwe economics. No one talks about QE like that anymore. It just talks about it as part of the policy toolkit.
Temptation for all of us is to say, well, no, actually, the conditions weren't quite are different this time. And so I want to look forward to, would central banks justify more unconventional, possibly more untested versions, because they will say, well, this situation is new. And what about the situation is going to be new, Alex?
So I think the difference that we're talking about here is that when we talk about QE, what we were really doing when we were buying government bonds is we were switching the debt of the government from a 10-year bond, let's say, to cash. But the overall size of that combined government balance sheet, so the government debt plus the notes that the central bank issues, the overall size of that was remaining the same. What we're talking about here is actually direct financing spending. So it'd be the spending component that is really different. Mm-hmm. And having the ability to finance unlimited spending is what we're talking about. Not necessarily just the central bank before, and you know, with the benefit of hindsight and a lot more years to think about it, we can come up with a justifiable reason why we didn't get a hyperinflation. But what you were really seeing was just a reshuffling, a reprofiling of the government's debt, to bring down interest rates across different maturities. But now what we're really talking about is an unlimited ability to spend. And you'd have to not believe in supply and demand, and so pushing demand infinitely high with restricted supply to believe that didn't cause inflation, that didn't lead to higher inflationary outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought that was extremely well put. I mean, the only thing I'd add is that the real hardcore hyperinflationists. Mm-hmm. Would say, yeah, but you know, just you wait.
Just wait.
You know, we're 10 years on, but just you wait.
It's
coming. Yeah.
Finally, to wrap this up, I want to bring it to your latest piece about central bank freedom, and you come up with kind of two lessons that you feel like central policymakers are really going to take from the experience of Japan, which, as you mentioned, is kind of the only bank that's really achieved kind of broadly flat inflation. And that was, a bank really needs to spend, or policymakers really need to spend, and that PR matters. Could you explain a little bit more about your two takeaways, or what you feel like are the takeaways for policymakers?
Yeah, I'll let Alex do PR matters. But the first one, I think, is really the kind of answer to the previous question in different ways. It's not that the banks need to spend, it's that the fiscal authorities need to spend. Mm-hmm. So helicopter money, augmented QE, it's not really about the monetary side, it's about the fiscal side. So it's about people genuinely recognizing, as they kind of sit in the treasuries and finance ministries around the world, that when there is a big demand shortfall, you should fill that. You should fill that by cutting taxes. You should fill that by employing people to build roads, to improve infrastructure, whatever you want. Anything that pushes out aggregate demand is likely to be inflationary. So the spending really the lesson there is on the finance ministries and the treasuries, less on the central banks. But I'll let Alex take the PR point.
Yeah, well, I think that the combination, so when we talked about the combination, announcing that I have this indefinite ability to spend that allows market participants to think, well, yes, yes, I can see that you do, and it's credible. The impact of that...
Credibility being the key word there.
Yeah. So the impact of the announcement can be just as powerful as the actual spending, mm-hmm. in moving people's expectations of where demand is going to be, of where inflation is going to be, which will move market expectations at the same time. And that can be self-fulfilling.
But we talk a lot about market expectations, but this is just about people's expectations and corporate's expectations. Like, so a big announcement. I mean, imagine it's 2 or 3 years. Let's push it into the future. Let's say it's 10 years down the line. Mm-hmm. There's a big economic shock for whatever reason. People are worried about losing their jobs. People are worried about not being able to have the money to fill their household budget needs over the next month and couple of months. Front page news, the government is launching this big spending program. Mm. And by that, we don't mean, let's cut VAT by a couple of points and let's have a a tiny little tweak to the overall budget envelope. It's like a proper spending program. Mm. And this is the New Deal in the 1930s. That's exactly what it was. You can kind of argue about the monetary side, but the New Deal was an explicit: the government is going to open the taps. We're going to build the Hoover Dam. We're going to get America working again. And this is kind of what we're talking about. That is kind of what helicopter money in conception is. It's doing that, and doing that in a way where nobody has to have any concerns about whether it's whether they can finance it. If you're doing it on your own, you've got to have a lot of concerns about where your exchange rate goes. So there's a big point about kind of international coordination in this kind of circumstance, but that's not, it's not impossible. I mean, we saw international coordination in the aftermath of the last crisis. We saw central banks around the world cut interest rates on exactly the same day because they wanted to send a very powerful, very credible message to both the markets and the wider world. And we're kind of talking about, let's take that kind of policy and dial it up to 11.
In true Spinal Tap form. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alex and Chris. To find out more about their fascinating research, go onto our website and find their long-term thinking articles, Unconventional Policy in the Next Downturn, and their latest article, Freedom for the Central Banks. My thanks to the production team and our wonderful producer, Holly McNulty. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal and General Investment Management. Legal and General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal and General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.